This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
Summer 1977. In the city of New York, a year-long nightmare was coming to an end. On August 10th, a man named David Berkowitz was arrested. Police believed that he was a lone gunman behind the Son of Sam killings, a brutal series of shootings that had left six people dead and seven seriously injured. The media rejoiced. The elusive Son of Sam was behind bars. Or was he?
The general perception among the public for years had been that David Berkowitz was a lone gunman. The facts and the evidence, not speculation, the facts and the evidence say otherwise.
In 1977, the nation believed the Son of Sam murders were solved. But in the last 11 years, reporter Maury Terry has collected convincing evidence that David Berkowitz did not act alone. Tonight, we examine Terry's theory and present other mysteries where you may be able to help. In a tiny Baptist church in rural Georgia, a deacon and his wife were the victims of a double murder. The killer dropped a pair of glasses that may lead to his identity. And from Omaha, Nebraska, a poignant story of unrequited love, a frugal bachelor who left an unclaimed fortune of $200,000. Someone watching tonight may be his heir. Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Son of Sam's reign of terror began on July 29, 1976. It occurred in an area in the Bronx called Pelham Bay. The time was 1:10 a.m. Two young girls were hit by .44 caliber bullets. One died. A composite sketch of the gunman was created from the survivor's eyewitness description. On October 23rd, in the borough of Queens, another .44 caliber shooting occurred. A man suffered a serious head injury. A month later, again in Queens, two girls stood on a stoop talking. A man appeared out of the shadows. Both survived, but one would be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of her life. Eyewitnesses were able to help police in creating a new composite of the gunman. 1977. Two separate shootings took the lives of two women. As in the earlier attacks, a .44 caliber bulldog revolver was used. Eyewitnesses created two more composites of the killer. They showed a very different face from the earlier drawings. Each appeared to be a different person. On April 17, 1977, another shooting occurred, again in the Pelham Bay section of the Bronx, just three blocks from the scene of the first shooting. This time, a hand-printed letter was left at the scene. It read, quote, "I am a monster. I am the Son of Sam. I'm a little brat." The city was paralyzed with fear.
The people in the local neighborhoods, particularly in the Bronx, were petrified. I remember people yelling to people in the street, "Get in, that nut's out there." And this is an early afternoon. No one double parked their cars. Business at the local entertainment places such as bars, restaurants, were nil. No one went out.
On Memorial Day, another letter from the Son of Sam was sent to columnist Jimmy Breslin. Written in the same distinctive style, It contained taunts and references to Satanism. Finally, on July 31st, Son of Sam struck for the last time. Stacy Moskowitz was killed, her date Robert Violante partially blinded.
He just walked up to them, shot them.
A 19-year-old mechanic named Tommy Zeno was an eyewitness.
That guy came over to the car and blew those people away in less than 4 seconds. Like, you know, you press the trigger and their boat would, you know, boat could have died. Luckily, Robert's alive. But I'll never forget it.
Zeno gave police a description of the shooter. Another composite was created showing the gunman. Again, there were more differences and similarities when compared to the earlier drawings.
One of them or two looked like David Berkowitz. The others did not resemble him at all. It was completely different. I thought it was rather strange, although we know that these drawings are done by victims or witnesses who see the killer for a brief period of time. And then a day or two or several hours later, they have to go to a police department artist, and he has to put that on paper. That's a very difficult thing to do. So many times these sketches are not very accurate. So I thought perhaps maybe that's why we saw so many different versions of the Son of Sam on the composites.
In their investigation of the Moskowitz shooting, police discovered a parking ticket had been issued near the scene to a Ford Galaxy owned by a postal employee named David Berkowitz.
Just took off right back into the park.
The police traced this ticket to Berkowitz's home. As they approached the building, they saw the car. They spotted a duffel bag with what looked like a rifle butt protruding through the opening. When they entered the car, they found a letter threatening another attack. It was signed Son of Sam.
Hey, John, look at this. We got him.
Let's head back to these and get a warrant for this.
The police staked out the Ford Galaxy, waiting for its owner to emerge. At 10 p.m., Berkowitz walked to the car. Inside the brown paper bag he was carrying, there was a .44 caliber revolver. As detectives moved in to arrest him, he sat in his Ford Galaxy, almost passively.
What took you guys so long?
Step out of the car. Turn around.
Berkowitz confessed to all of the shootings. He told the police that he received his orders to commit the crimes from the barking dog of an elderly neighbor named Sam Carr. Berkowitz pleaded guilty to all the charges against him. He was sentenced to 25 years to life in New York's Attica prison. But to Maury Terry, his confession seemed too convenient.
After the arrest of Berkowitz, just through fate or whatever, I started poking around into the case because I had some suspicions that maybe there was more to it than the public was being led to believe. And that's when I started my own investigation into the case, right really the day after Berkowitz got arrested.
Maury Terry believes that David Berkowitz did not act alone, that he was part of a gang of killers, and it was the killing of Stacy Moskowitz that first aroused his suspicions. Next, we will go through a step-by-step reconstruction of the events leading to the killing of Stacy Moskowitz. Maury Terry believes that this last killing was deliberately planned and executed, not just by David Berkowitz, but by at least three people. And he says that there is eyewitness testimony to corroborate this theory.
Well, the very early reports that on the Moskowitz killing had me concerned. David Berkowitz's resemblance, his features were widely different from the sketches of the killer that had been done by the police artist. Started seeking out witnesses, found Tommy Zeno, who was a key witness to the shooting.
Tommy Zeno was with his girlfriend parked on Shore Parkway in front of the car that held Stacy Moskowitz and her boyfriend.
I was looking through the mirror of the car, and I noticed somebody, you know, standing in the park. What I seen is he had long hair, and it's hard to really see the face, but he was thin. He looked like he was in pretty good shape.
He danced good.
From looking through the mirror when he was in the park, the guy that came over to the car.
It's not nice.
He walked up to the car like as if he was gonna get in the car. And then he went into a stance. Shot. And that was it. Turned around and ran. I can't picture Berkowitz running like that. That's the thing that confused me after they caught him. If they seen him, it's either in a week he can't get that fat, you know? That's all I could say. He didn't look like the type of guy to run and do that.
This is a map showing the neighborhood where the last killing occurred. Stacy Moskowitz and her boyfriend were parked here. Two blocks away on Bay 17th Street, David Berkowitz received the incriminating parking ticket on his Ford Galaxy, parked here. According to Terry, the events leading up to the shooting began here at the Shore Parkway entrance to the park at about 1 a.m. Witnesses saw a yellow Volkswagen arrive at the park entrance. Two men emerged. The same car was seen fleeing the crime scene after the shootings. 30 minutes later, Tommy Zeno noticed the yellow Volkswagen drive past more than once. A half hour later, at 2:05, a policeman issued a parking ticket to Berkowitz's Ford Galaxy. A neighborhood resident named Cecilia Davis pulled up in a friend's car just ahead of Berkowitz's Ford. She then said goodbye to her friend.
That was such a nice lady.
We were triple packed, and I was looking in the back, so in case a car comes up, I saw that guy taking the summons off his windshield and keep on looking, watching the cops as they still gave tickets. Then he got in the car and he came behind us. He couldn't pass because we were blocking the whole street. And he blew the horn at us.
So, I gotta go.
So I got out and I took a look at him. More or less, I gave him a dirty look. What's the big rush in the middle of the night?
Cecilia has identified the man in the car as David Berkowitz. After she left her friend, she saw Berkowitz drive up Bay 17th Street and turn right on Bath, following the police.
The fact that David Berkowitz pulled up behind Mrs. Davis and her date as he did, with the police car still on the block or just pulling off the block, blaring his horn, he would not be doing something like that if he's the elusive, ingenious Son of Sam carrying that .44 Bulldog in his car. He would try to be as stealthy as possible.
15 minutes after the parking ticket was issued, Stacy Moskowitz and Robert Violante went for a late-night stroll. As they walked in a nearby park, Stacy and Robert saw a man standing next to a restroom, watching them. This restroom was over two blocks from Cecilia Davis's apartment. At 2:33 a.m., Mrs. Davis returned to her apartment after walking her dog. She saw David Berkowitz, the man who had honked earlier, walking straight towards her.
I know it was the same guy because I saw him when I got out of the car for my friend. I looked at him because he blowed a horn.
Cecilia saw Berkowitz here, over two blocks away from where Stacy and Robert were parked. Approximately 1 minute later in her apartment, Cecilia heard the sounds of gunfire in the distance. Those four shots killed Stacy Moskowitz and almost blinded Robert Violante. How could Berkowitz have traveled from this spot where Cecilia last saw him to this area where Stacy and Robert were shot in 1 minute, when it takes at least 2.5 minutes to briskly walk the two blocks from Bay 17th Street to the park? Just 15 seconds after the shooting, witnesses saw a man wearing a cheap light-colored wig run out of the park, get into a yellow Volkswagen, and speed away up 17th Avenue. In his haste, he ran a red light and narrowly missed colliding with another car. Maury Terry believes that at least three people, including David Berkowitz, were involved in the Moskowitz killing. He claims they were members of an organized conspiracy responsible for every single one of the Son of Sam shootings.
David Berkowitz was selected to be the fall guy on the Son of Sam killings. He was not a willing fall guy. He wanted it to be another way, but Berkowitz knew that he had been involved in all of the shootings. He has pulled the trigger definitely two times, responsible for three murders. He's not an innocent man, and was on the scene of all the others as a lookout, a wheelman, whatever. So Berkowitz was involved, and Berkowitz knew he was guilty. He also was responsible for getting a parking ticket on his car that night, which also made him susceptible to be the guy to be picked out to take the fall. And on top of that, the real killer escaped in the yellow Volkswagen, and that person was deemed more valuable to the conspirators than David Berkowitz was.
No, I didn't think it was David Berkowitz then, and I don't think it's him now. I definitely don't think it's him.
It has crossed my mind, and it's a strong opinion of mine, that David Berkowitz was not the sole killer and was aided by other accomplices.
We received information that other people may have been involved. I had a statement made to me by someone who allegedly spoke to David Berkowitz, wherein David Berkowitz is supposed to have stated that others were involved.
New York prosecutor John Santucci has moved the status of the Son of Sam investigation from inactive to active. Next week, we'll continue Maury Terry's investigation. He has discovered that David Berkowitz and at least two friends were members of a satanic cult. These two friends were brothers, and their father's name was Sam. Next, the poignant tale of Curly Green. For half a century, he lived a solitary, frugal life in a tiny Omaha apartment. When he died, his friends were amazed that he had amassed a $200,000 fortune. Someone watching tonight may be his heir. Until 10 years ago, Walter Green lived alone in a small apartment near downtown Omaha. His nickname was Curly, and he lived a simple, frugal life. He was cordial to his neighbors, but kept mostly to himself. On April 24, 1978, Curly Green had a heart attack. He died while working in his yard. Everyone who knew him was astounded to find that Curly, during his lifetime, had accumulated more than $200,000. He left no will, and his next of kin could not be located. 10 years after his death, Curly Green's fortune remains the largest unclaimed estate in Nebraska history.
When it came out in the papers that he had the amount of money that they said he had, we were shocked. I can't imagine how he amassed that amount.
They found stock certificates, I understand. They found a coin collection. And they found, much to everyone's surprise, that Curly actually owned the apartment building where he was living.
It is extraordinary that a man who lived as simply as Curly Green could have accrued such a large sum of money. It is even more extraordinary that the money remains unclaimed. But this is not just a story of missing heirs and unclaimed fortunes. It is also a love story, a sweet and haunting one that began nearly 8 decades ago. We don't know much about Curly Green's early life. What we can surmise is this. When he was nearly 17, he hopped a train bound for Omaha. Curly jumped off outside the city, near a small farming town called Schuyler. Curly immediately began to pound the pavement, looking for work. Hal Rominger, a local tavern keeper, saw the young stranger and offered him not only a ride, but a home-cooked meal with his family. Catherine, the younger of the Rominger girls, was then only 9 years old.
I don't know why Dad brought him. We supposed he came from Denver. We were curious when he sat at the table because we'd never seen him before. But he was a nice-looking young man.
Well, I'll bet it's been quite some time since you smelled cooking like this, Curly.
Well, yeah, a little while.
At dinner, Curly was secretive about his family
in his birthplace in Montana.
Porch family, Curly.
Well, I left my mom and my stepdad back in Denver, and that's about all the family I really have.
Curly said he hadn't gotten along with his stepfather, so he had traveled east.
He had a very nice way of evading. See, when Mama asked him, said, didn't you have some cousins or something? He just said, well, I did once. And he changed the subject. And that's the way Curly was. And we respected him for it.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Well, none as pretty as your daughters, ma'am.
The moment Curly first saw Jessamine Rominger, Catherine's older sister, he was smitten. He would never feel the same way about anyone else. Al Rominger found Curly a job working at the local garage. The automobile was still a pretty newfangled machine, but Curly had a knack for fixing cars. He earned enough to enable him to move into a boarding house.
He wasn't a spendthrift, and I used to like it when I have to get paychecks, because he'd give me nickels and dimes.
With his new salary, Curly began to court Jessamine. He only had one problem. Getting rid of Catherine, the little sister.
Go to the movies. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of the park. How about if you go to the movies and me and Jessamine go to the park?
Okay.
Okay.
Well, here we are.
He and Jessamine would go wherever they went. They had some friends in Schuyler. But I didn't care where he went. I got the nickel and dime. That's all I cared about. Curly thought quite a bit of Jessamine because he never went with other girls, only Jessamine.
In 1917, Curly left his job as a mechanic to enlist in the Army. He also left his beloved Jessamine. She began training to be a nurse. Curly served on the European front. It was his unenviable duty to drive the dead and wounded to the makeshift army hospital. The suffering he witnessed scarred Curly. But when the war ended, he returned home, full of hope, to Schuyler, Nebraska, and to Jessamine.
Catherine, it's good to see you again. How have you been?
Fine.
Is Jessamine here?
No, Curly. I'm sorry. She's gone to Omaha.
Well, got these flowers. Yeah.
Jessamine liked him, and he was a gentleman always. But she wanted other things out of life. And he didn't appear to be educated. And his earning capacity wasn't great, I suppose. And anyhow, they didn't go together anymore.
Curly followed Jessamine to Omaha and got a job. First as a mechanic at a newspaper, the Omaha Bee, then as a night watchman for the Union Pacific Railroad. Curly refused to give up on Jessamine. But Jessamine Rominger married another man. Curly never fell in love again. He never married or had a family. Curly spent the next 60 years alone. In all those years, he never told anyone who his real family was. Other than Catherine, Curly's best friend was Riley Marr, his barber and a fellow member of the Masonic Lodge.
I really never really got that close to him, actually. I thought I was a pretty good friend of his because he did invite me over to his home on occasion, and we did sit around and have a cup of coffee and talked about things.
Once, Riley noticed some postcards and pictures neatly displayed in Curly's apartment. He was curious to know if they were from Curly's family.
And I picked one of them up, and it had a postmark of Brooklyn, New York, and I asked him something about where that was. It was a long ways from home, and he said, never mind, and he took it and put it away. Well, it made me feel like I was probably intruding on his privacy of some sort, and that he had something that he maybe didn't want revealed, or maybe he'd had a tragedy in his lifetime somewhere along the way that he was trying to avoid talking about.
Over the years, Curly had amassed a considerable fortune, but he kept that a secret, too. Some people attributed Curly's wealth to an extremely valuable coin collection. But Catherine thought he just plain saved every penny he made.
Well, he said he would get up in the morning, and after he'd eat breakfast, he'd put a can on the pilot light. And by the time he'd come back and ready for lunch or the evening meal, it was just right to eat. He was that saving. Maybe that's how he got the money.
When he died, Curly Green had accumulated a fortune of more than $200,000, held primarily in real estate, stocks, and bonds. So far, no legitimate heirs have claimed Curly's estate. In 1986, investigator Josh Butler, who tracks down missing heirs professionally, began researching the case of Curly Green. Josh had heard that Curly once mentioned having a brother who was killed in a shootout.
Indeed, there had been a man named Al Green who was shot and killed shortly after the 4th of July in 1921. We really went to some extremes in this case, but were surprised and a little disappointed never to have found any clear connection with Curly Green. Part of the mystery here is that Al Green's father, I believe to have been a Joseph Green, and I now understand that Curly Green's father was a Harry Albert Green. So quite probably Al Green and Curly Green were cousins rather than brothers.
The man named Al Green was killed in 1921. Josh Butler now thinks it is probable that Curly's actual brother was killed several years earlier. The search for Curly's heirs continues.
It's very strange that a man would accumulate $200,000 in his lifetime and that he would have no known relatives that anybody knew about and not leave some sort of a written document concerning the disposition of this money. Somewhere there's somebody who has enough information in their own family that they're going to be able to come forward and prove their entitlement to this. It'll be a case of going from the people back to the money.
These are five of the few known photographs of Curly Green, showing him as a young man, in middle age, and before he died. We know he said he was born in Kendall, Montana, and lived in Denver. We know he had a collection of gold coins, some of which he might have obtained in Mexico. He received postcards from someone in Brooklyn, New York. Curly claimed he had a brother who was killed in a shootout. And he stated on a 1938 birth certificate that Albert Harry Green, born in England, and Anne Morin Green, born in Latvia, were his parents. None of these three relatives has been traced. At Curly's funeral, a mysterious wreath of flowers became the final clue to his past. This card came with the flowers. It signed Mrs. Joe Greener, Denver, Colorado. Perhaps Mrs. Greener is the key to the puzzling life of Walter Curly Green. Next, the story of a double murder in a tiny Baptist church in rural Georgia. The only clue is a pair of ordinary glasses left behind by the killer. Georgia, population 825, is a predominantly black community nestled in the Baptist Bible Belt. Lumber, farming, and the paper mill provide the income for this small, isolated area over 35 miles from the nearest big city, Jacksonville, Florida. For years, Rising Daughters Baptist Church has served not only as a place of worship, but also as a social center for the small township. But on March 11th, 1985, this quiet community was shattered by violence. The quiet sanctity of Rising Daughters Church was violated by the brutal double murder of Harold and Thelma Swain. Harold Swain was a well-respected deacon of the church, a member of the county jury commission, and a spokesperson for the black community. Thelma Swain was also closely involved with church affairs. Harold and Thelma had been married for over 43 years.
Harold was always happy and jolly, laughing. It's something like that might have come natural to Harold because
his love and kindness for everyone. And he would always go out of his way to help someone at any time, day or night, no matter what time. If you needed a favor of any type and he could do it, he was there. Same thing about Thelma.
All the people up here, well, they came to his funeral. Most people I ever saw at a funeral here in my life. Just because everybody, you know, thought that much of Harold and respected.
On the night they were murdered, Harold and Thelma held their weekly Tuesday night Bible class. 9 women attended.
Lord, do I put my trust? Let me never be put to confusion. Now let us pray. Oh God, I want to thank you for bringing us together tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen.
Now, is there any further business that you care to discuss, Sister Brenda?
Yeah, well, I'd like to remind everybody about...
At 8:50, one of the women excused herself early.
I have to go near to pick my daughter up from work.
Okay.
Maybe that would help resolve this situation.
May I help you?
Yeah, I want to talk to somebody.
Who?
Some money in there.
She encountered a stranger in the church vestibule.
I want to talk to him.
I'll be right back.
Some of the other women in the group caught just a glimpse of the man, a young white male.
In April?
Excuse me, sister.
We're going to
have to
go to you again. I'll see you later. What's happening?
Women rushed into the pastor's office and tried to call for help. The phone didn't work.
Stay.
Oh,
20 minutes passed while the women waited in fear. Finally, one of them made a dash for her car and went to summon help. That night, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation was brought in, and a massive manhunt started. This tiny black community.
Harold and Thelma were personal friends of mine and my family's. And it was kind of a shock to me. I think I was in shock for a while. When I got there, there was a lot of confusion. No one really knew what had happened. They didn't know what the facts were. They didn't know who had done the killing. They didn't know what the motive was.
The Swains, highly respected people. Very active in the community, are just not the type of person that, would be the victim of a murder plot. There was a lot of physical evidence at the scene. Bullet casings, 2 pair of glasses. For one, we were able to determine belonged to Harold Swain. The other pair, no one knew who they belonged to. The first gut reaction that I had was a transient, because the glasses appeared to belong to a person who did not have enough money to properly maintain their glasses or to buy glasses when they needed them.
These are the glasses found on that night, and they're not ordinary glasses. The lenses are thick, the surface pocked by a welding torch. The earpieces don't match. Were they dropped by the killer? When the police discovered these glasses, they investigated the theory that the murderer may have been a transient.
Rising Daughters Church is located on busy Highway 17. Transients often would stop by for a handout or a free meal. But if robbery was the motive, why were over $300 left in Harold Swain's pocket? Other evidence suggests that the crime was premeditated. The authorities feel that the church had been cased before the brutal attack.
The telephone lines at the church had been cut, which could or could not say that it was a premeditated murder. It could have been a premeditated armed robbery attempt.
The woman who left the church early clearly saw the attacker. Fearing for her life, she did not want to appear on camera.
He was calm. I was thinking that he was there for a handout. He didn't seem to be someone to hurt anybody. I didn't see any weapon or anything. And it seemed like he had on scuffed boots. And he had long blonde hair, shoulder-length hair. But I really wasn't looking at him that hard, you know, because I wanted to leave.
Hi, can I help you with something?
The police attempted to create a picture of the killer using an identikit, but the eyewitnesses did not agree on many of the details. An artist was brought in to sketch a composite drawing. For 5 months, the police searched for the killer using the composite drawing, but no new leads or clues surfaced. Finally, on July 5th, 1985, police 135 miles away in Telfair County, Georgia, pulled over a car for a minor traffic violation. In the trunk, they found an automatic weapon and a submachine gun. Three suspects were taken into custody. One of them was Donnie Barringtine.
We were given some information by some acquaintance of these people that Donnie Barringtine had told people in Florida that he had murdered a black preacher and his wife in a church. After several interviews with Donnie, he admitted that he had told these people in Florida that he killed a black preacher and his wife. And then he just smiled and said, but I was lying to him. We have never been able to come up with any hard evidence to connect Donnie with this case.
Donnie Barringtine was then given a polygraph test, and he flunked it. As a matter of fact, the polygraph operator told us that Mr. Barringtine was a very good suspect in the murder.
The resemblance between the man on the wanted poster and Donnie Barringtine was inconclusive. So the eyewitnesses from the church in Waverly were taken to Jacksonville for a police lineup.
These people cannot see you.
You'll be viewing five individuals. I'd like, if you will, to place yourself in your mind back at the church the night that this incident happened. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Five individuals on the other side won't be able to see or hear you. Lights.
Lights.
There was about six men there. And I really couldn't say that one of them was him, you know, because the person I saw had short hair. His complexion was a little bit lighter, but he had the same boots that I saw that night. The boots was what I recognized. But I wasn't really, really sure.
The murder charges against Donnie Barringtine were not pursued, but he was subsequently convicted on weapons charges and is currently serving 5 years in a federal penitentiary. 1 year later, the Swain investigation took a new direction. Agent Joe Gregory came across a face in a state crime bulletin which exactly matched the identikit picture created by one of the witnesses at the church.
It gave me a chill. It literally gave me a chill when I saw the composite because there are so many hundreds of thousands of combinations to make a composite. And what are the odds that two of them being exact, and these composites were exact matches.
The Kansas suspect was wanted for armed robbery in a church, but was never taken into custody. The Kansas Bureau of Investigation could not even give Agent Gregory the suspect's name.
And we found that they had never developed any leads. They don't know who he is, other than the fact that he drove an older car with a Florida tag on it.
3 years later, the brutal murders of Harold and Thelma Swain remain a mystery. Were they just random killings committed by a violent transient? Or were they a planned and premeditated murder? And if so, why?
They say your first hunch is usually your best. Everything that night pointed to a transient attempting to pull a robbery.
My feelings are in that the individual did not get any money. He went around and checked to find out if there was a phone and then cut those lines and singled out one individual from the church and brought him out to the vestibule, shot him, and then, in my opinion, intended that he be dead. He shot him the last round in the temple. There's no question that his intent was to kill Harold Swain.
Personally, a case like this haunts you. It's the type of case that you never forget. I drive by Rising Daughters every day coming into this county. And I never drive by that I don't look and think about the Swains.
Last February on Unsolved Mysteries, we examined the case of Elmer DeBoer, an oil company courier who was murdered, execution style, on May 11, 1987. The two key suspects in the case were Jerry Strickland and his 16-year-old girlfriend, Missy Mundy. Local police believe the couple kidnapped Elmer, robbed him of $10,000, then took him to a deserted wooded area outside of Pontiac, Michigan, and murdered him. Jerry and Missy were never seen again. Update, Moses Lake, Washington. Within minutes of our broadcast, 20 viewers in this small rural community called the police to say they recognized Jerry Strickland and Missy Mundy. 7 hours later, the police arrested the fugitive couple at a friend's house. They discovered that Jerry and Missy had themselves watched the broadcast and were waiting for the police.
All he said is, "I'm the guy you're looking for." And he was just real calm and collect, no violence at all.
I figured the time was about 7 hours and 15 minutes from the time the Unsolved Mysteries aired and he was in custody. I just felt super about it.
On February 12th, Jerry and Missy were extradited back to Michigan to stand trial for armed robbery, kidnapping, and murder. Jerry insists they are innocent.
They got circumstance of evidence, all hearsay. It's people talking, but no witnesses. I mean, okay? That's why, you know, I say they're going to learn that we didn't do this.
We have enough evidence, circumstantial evidence and physical evidence, that we feel he's guilty.
All they want is a conviction, and they don't care if they burn me or not.
Thanks to our viewers, Jerry Strickland and Missy Mundy will have their day in court. They're being tried separately, and if convicted, could face life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Next week, we'll continue our examination of the Son of Sam shootings. Reporter Maury Terry claims that the attacks were engineered by a satanic cult, a cult he believes is still alive and has not yet been brought to justice. Join us next week for another edition of Unsolved Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.